I sometimes feel that I'm falling or a sensation close to falling. Can you please explain that feeling? So, thank you. So, when they really start to, this is one way of interpreting it. When you really start to let go, and then you get that sense of when you really like release your grip, like a state of like non-attachment, the state of letting go, then you may feel that your attention is like dropping down. It could be maybe a little bit similar to like for anyone who's done parachute jumping, even probably little things like abseiling, where you're abseiling and you drop down maybe, you know, could be at least 25, 50 meters, almost like very, very high speed, not free fall, but a bit short of that. But the parachuting principle would give you a fairly accurate, as close as you can get, kind of comparison. But it comes from that one way of that. It comes from that sense of letting go of attachments. It's a big one. Dear Achan, in the tradition of Theravada Buddhism, which monastics were widely regarded as fully awakened arahants? We have, of course, the Buddha, and in modern times, Achan Mun and Achan Cha, along with some less well-known disciples of theirs, but who is there after the Buddha in the intervening 2,500 years? It would be inspiring to read about them and hear their teachings in whatever form they might be recorded. Each arahant is different. Thanks, and with metta. So I was in Thailand, how long have I been back? Say a couple of weeks. And so Palini, our Thai tour leader, who was born in Thailand, speaks fluent Thai, she took us around to a number of monasteries where the teachers there are reputed to be, fully enlightened, either partially or fully. Enlightened, and some of these monasteries were very peaceful, very secluded, like, you know, maybe at least, nothing incredible, but at least a couple of kilometres off, say like a country road, and you just couldn't hear anything. You couldn't even hear motorcycles. They were out on a state forest, maybe national park area, and, you know, you've got thousands of monasteries in Thailand, maybe 10% of the monks are forest monks. But even with the development in Thailand, you can still find very quiet places, but you just need to know where they are. And so, for example, for the Westerners who go to Thailand, if you went to Wat Pa Nanachat, the Western monks, especially who've been there for at least, say, minimum 5 years or 10, or even especially the abbot, Achan Kavili of Wat Pa Nanachat, who's German-born but speaks very good English and very good Thai, would know exactly where those places are, because the Western monks, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for good meditation monasteries, very quiet places where they can just get on with their practice. And so, we must have visited at least, well over, at least six or seven places where the teachers were, largely fully enlightened. And in order to access their teachings, if you get, I just downloaded an app for one person, and access to insight has a number of books by a number of leading teachers in Thailand that I can think of. There must be at least half a dozen I can think of, maybe even more. So if you go into, say, Access to Insight, Badachan Tanisro with Apple or Android devices, I think even Windows as well, the Windows download. And so you go into, what would it be, say, Forest Tradition, and then you'll see the authors of all the Thai books in English translation, and there'll be a number of them, you know, a number of fully enlightened teachers there. And you can, the way that, I mean, you can't necessarily, we, you know, we can't prove those teachers are even partially enlightened, but they gain that reputation over many, many years, so absolute minimum 10, 20 years plus, because if you've really got the goods, if you've got that level of attainment, and then it eventually, over time, it becomes known. And when people are mixing with you, when they see your level of teaching, when they see your personal standard, they see the way you run your monasteries, and it becomes understood that this person has fully realized the Dhamma, and it usually comes out in the personal standard of their own practice. They're very, very tight with their precepts. So for example, Achan Ban, we went to see Achan Ban, who's out up, I don't know the exact location, up past Chiang Mai, between Chiang Mai, Chiang Rai, and he's got one of the most famous, his monastery is one of probably the, say for example, the 10 most famous, but his monastery is just exceptional. The quality, it's not like really, wealthy, rich, indulgent and affluent, but whatever they've built there, it's really good quality. It's simple dwellings, buildings, this and that, but even the gardens and the cement and the staircases, they've all done to a really high standard of finish, polish, rounded edges. Everything's done like really, really well. Top class tradesmen. They didn't get like, you know, cheap teams of guys to do say like a multi-level garden complex. You know, they probably got the best people that money could buy. But you're looking at levels of like simplicity. Things are simple, but they're top class, really well done, and no shoddy workmanship. And the meditation hall was just incredible. You're not supposed to take. I didn't take any photographs in the upper area because there were too many Thai monks around. But my friend did get a couple of snaps, and the meditation hall, they didn't rip out the boulders which actually existed on the top of the high hill section. They built the sala around the boulders, and the boulders might be about a quarter of the one boulder would be a quarter of the size of this room, and the sala is built around these massive boulders. And the floor section, I get the impression it's a dark wood, so it's probably polished teak, and it's like it's got a mirror finish. You know, just top class people in to do the work, and the floor was absolutely unmarked, unscratched, like a mirror right across from start to finish, and built around these massive. Boulders that look like maybe sort of like a darker, similar to what we've got. It's like a sandstone. Once you get under that dark finish, then you get the colour. You get the kind of sandstone, but rocky outcrops, and the whole top of the hill section covered with rocks, and the kutis built on the rocks. But you know, and so you're going to get the heat coming up from the stone, but you know, you've got this constant breeze running through, and it was almost like a Zen kind of appearance the way they'd actually done things, but Achan Ban, oh, he's really, really strict, and he's got very strong psychic ability. And any of his monks, you know, if they wake up late, or if they, you know, they go to bed early, and he even knows what people are dreaming. You know, just like people normally dream at night, he even knows what people are dreaming about. And he's really tough, like on his monks. He'll just jump right on them if they even step out of line an inch. He's probably, you know, he's quite compassionate, but really strict. But the monastery itself was just absolutely beautiful. It's just a work of art. They don't allow the lay disciples to. They can't move into the upper area. They can't take. I think they're not allowed to take even photographs in that lower section. But really, really beautiful place. But we saw a number of them, and very, maybe a bit more simple than that, but very clean, tidy, very good personal standard, and quite peaceful, you know, very meditation-based facilities. And I got probably about, I'm not sure if it was 500-odd photographs, possibly. But we saw a number of monasteries where you've got caves going into the cliffs. You've got like large overhangs with a small, say, a small waterfall down the left side, and then you've got this massive overhang. So a waterfall on the left, and then a massive overhang, and the overhang goes inwards to an enclosure. So it's like with the water there, it's like a refrigerator. So it's so even on a warmish day. I mean, when we were there, it was cool, but even on a warm day, you just move into this enclosure, and it's just so cool. You know, you've got the running water on the side, which cools the air, and many of the enlightened teachers in that Ubon vicinity. They passed through there and they stayed in that place and they stayed in that cave because you had a water supply, you had the sandstone overhang, and they leveled it off and they tiled it. And I mean, you know, you can, if it wasn't for the fact that they had a community there, you can easily live in these places. And one monastery we went to, who the senior teacher, who was supposedly fully enlightened, had died previously. He'd actually died in the sitting posture, and his body, even with the tropical heat, his body didn't actually break down. And they gold leafed his body, and it didn't actually, it mummified, it didn't even decay, even with the tropical heat. And where he was living and practicing, there's a keyhole formation, and as you move in, the keyhole opens out into a chamber. The chamber narrows down, and then it opens into a small chamber. Further back, and it's quite high, and they would have definitely had lots of bats in there, and so they it was still quite simply done, you know, with the tiles, with the shrine, but really cool, like a refrigerator. But unfortunately, they were building an external meditation hall so the lay fraternity could meditate, because there was really nowhere else for them to practice, and probably, you know, for community meetings, this kind of stuff. So we were trying to meditate in this sort of like five-star cave, and then we had the tradesmen like cutting pipe and welding, so they just basically just destroyed the atmosphere. There was a Thai girl there who'd come from one of the local villages, I mean about 100 k's away, and she was a regular meditator, and she learned her English from the MIT podcast programs on Android, and probably she wanted to chit chat with the Western monks. Probably she could understand about 90% of what we were talking about, but she was like really angry. She was working. She was probably meditating about 2 or 4 hours a day, and these guys were just driving her crazy, you know. And she complained to the teacher on a regular basis about the noise level. And she said even when I'm meditating at home, she says my house is better than the racket that these guys are making. He said my house is actually superior to this monastery at this point in time. And she complained, because she's quite a strong-willed young woman, that she complained to the abbot. And he said, yeah, he said all this anger, he said, it's coming from you, you know. He said all this conversation, it's coming from you, you know. And so whatever she was doing, it was always like, you know, the abbot kept saying, it's all you, you know. And so she wasn't too impressed about that. but it was, you know, other than the sala, it would have been a perfect place, you know, perfect place to go. But even Pali Nee, the Thai lady, she knows the exact names, the locations, and the teachers. So if you guys are interested in going to Thailand, you really need to, I would really study Thai for 12 months. You don't want to just bounce into one of these monasteries with no language at all, because it can be quite difficult. But I couldn't believe the amount of Thai monks who had basic English. Everywhere we went, the Thai monks, they knew just enough English, just barely enough maybe for very simple conversation. And there was one monk there at Plien's Monastery in outside of Chiang Mai, and his English was really good. He was working at the Westfield Shopping Centre, and he was in charge of the domestics. So he was the manager, say like the utilities, the cleaning manager for the domestics, and his English was basically fantastic. So he was able to you know, give some history and exactly what was happening, and the Bindabad, you know, the buildings and where we needed to be at certain times. He was married. I think he was going back. He was doing 2 months, 8 weeks, and then he was going back to his wife. I think he had a couple of young children, and he was running a business at the same time. So, yeah, Palini, if you're ever interested in knowing, like, finding quiet places, she's your person. Venerable, what can be done with the feeling of spinning while meditating? Spinning. So, what I would tend to do, say for example, if I had the sensation of spinning, I would tend to open my eyes and just to keep orientated, and I would tend to maybe ground myself in the physical body. Like maybe when you're meditating, focus on the feeling of that in the hands. Get yourself grounded in the body, or focus on the feeling in when one's feet touching the floor. And what else could you do? Remote possibility, maybe you could watch that dark space in the mind, might draw one's attention from that. And sort of examine it, you know, why do I have this experience in the first place? You know, try to gain some understanding why it's happening. Sometimes people have medical conditions, even mild vertigo, or say like even that fluid or pressure imbalance in the ear, or could even be past cum, you know, it could be all sorts of things. But it's a good idea to sort of explore this stuff and try to understand exactly what's happening. Otherwise, it tends to, if you ignore it, you know, if you don't pay attention to it, it tends to persist, these experiences. Today you mentioned the fear of running out of time to find enlightenment. How does this sit with myself? I thought time is a concept like any other which you detach yourself from. And my father argued this point, I said time is not a reality principle. Time is based on a state of change. So whether it's a nuclear clock, analog, digital, whatever, it's all based on a change of state. That's how we measure time with technology, with simple timepieces and whatnot. But the thing is, we're living in a world where we have these kind of principles, and so we have to measure so-called time between events, between location, between appointments. If we weren't able to use this kind of principle we've invented, we just wouldn't know where to be as far as time and place, connecting with people and this kind of thing. You know, if we didn't have that principle that we've created, I think we'd probably find it incredibly difficult to function whatsoever. But, you know, say for example, you know, like in the mind, in deep meditation, you don't have that experience of time at all. You know, people who experience the enlightenment stages, the nibbana element, they don't experience any sense of time whatsoever while they're in that very, very profound state of awakening. It's only when you come back to this world with our worldly say understanding and our worldly values, then we get back into that principle of time and change. But then again, you know, just a little thing. Between cultures, they have a slightly different perspective on time. In Switzerland and Germany, they expect you to be on time for appointments, you know, for whatever, coffee, this or that. But in Thailand, you know, you can be at least 5 minutes late. You could be maybe even 15 minutes late, and they don't really make such a fuss. Maybe like in Asian countries, it's a little bit more relaxed, but it all depends. You know, people, some of you who have international backgrounds maybe be quite familiar with that, but certain countries are very, you know, they If you're late for an appointment, maybe certain parts of Europe, I mean, they sort of want you, they want to know why, you know, why you rolled up like 2 minutes, you know, 2 minutes later. Is it useful when practicing meditation to think of the mind as a muscle which requires exertion, concentration, in order to become stronger? Not at all. So don't ever use, it's best not to use that word concentration with meditation at all, because it's really the wrong term. Any of you who get very, very good samadhi at any time, it's the amount, as I mentioned with one of the ladies, the level of mental effort you need to hold the meditation object to get into incredibly deep samadhi is basically nothing. So I'll just repeat what I said previously, but if you, for example, when you place your attention on your little finger or on your big toe or on the tip of your earlobe, the amount of effort it takes to move your attention to that spot, that's all it takes. All you have to do is contact the object. It's concentrating. The concentration, using effort, willpower, it's all nonsense. It's not like that at all. These people who get into jhanas, who get into the enlightenment stages, the amount of attention, the amount of mental effort is just touching the object of your meditation object of choice, and that's all it is. Nothing more than that. And even the most hopeless some people may feel their meditation's not very good at all, but it's only the thinking process which obstructs you. As soon as you're able to put that to one side, you automatically go right into these states, and the level of attention you need is that same thing again. All you do is just touch the object, and that's all it is. And those two principles, letting go of thinking, placing one's attention on the object, and you automatically go into very, very profound samadhi. So, but you know, the thing is, you're looking at skill. Force and pressure doesn't come into the equation. You're looking at skill in meditation, and I always say this: you've got to keep your insight practice at the same level of your samadhi. So if your samadhi is here, your wisdom has got to be there. If your samadhi is there, your wisdom has got to be there, or slightly stronger, because you know insight practice is one of the success principles for meditators. Samadhi in itself doesn't cut the ice. It's not enough, and not very few people, not many people I know whatsoever, can get profound meditation without deep reflection, understanding, and analysis of mind, thoughts, feelings, views, perceptions, and whatnot. What is the effect of full moon on meditation? Well, what the monks tend to notice is the mind has more mental energy. People tend to get better meditation on the full moon days. The Buddha got enlightened on a full moon day in May. He passed away on a full moon day. There was a couple of events. The major events took place in the Buddha the enlightenment, passing away. I'm not sure if there's a third one. I'd have to double check it. And so the full moon, so if that takes place for the Buddha, then it's something of great relevance. And you can feel it within yourself. The quality of your meditation is definitely better on the occasion of the full moon. You can actually feel it. Can you tell us where you go, what you do, aside from the teaching meditation side? Can you tell us where you go and what you do? Okay, what do I do? So where do I go? I definitely don't go to hell. And what do? I try to be virtuous. So, say for example, during the course of a year, I'm fairly like sort of low profile, and I'm really not interested in even, you know, I mean, like even though I've got 22 reigns now, and if I really pushed it, I could go to Malaysia, Singapore, say Malaysia, Singapore at most, you know, if I really was ambitious and wanted to be pushy and wanted to play teacher and all this kind of thing. But myself, I'm really not, I don't, what, say for example, this year, I helped to lead the group, going to Thailand, and I've got an invitation for, say for India for next February, and then for Thailand after that. If I get invited somewhere, I'll go, but I'm quite sort of low profile, and I'm not really interested in really sort of going all over the place. I just see too many disadvantages. If you're a meditation monk, you want to destroy your meditation, just do lots and lots of teaching appointments in different countries, and I absolutely guarantee you, you will never get deep in your practice and you will never get enlightened. But then again, I don't criticize people who do, because they do a lot of good quality Dharma work, and they teach to a very, very, how can I explain it, praiseworthy standard, clarity, full detail, they're knowledgeable, good communication skills. So even with the more scholarly monks, I see value and advantages in having good quality scholars and teachers who are based in study and research, who write books and articles. Because with many people who come to Dhamma, one of the main causes is because they pick up a book, or it could be maybe a research article, or some kind of, could be anything, could be archaeology, the history of Buddhism, something interesting, and then possibly they might do some more reading, and they might start to get into meditation and maybe join groups or go to Dharmaloka. Because not everyone just rolls up to Jada Grove. There's got to be some kind of connection. And most people connect on a more, in the beginning they connect on an intellectual basis, and then they start to connect on a feely-feely basis with retreat centres, with study groups and whatnot. Right. Yeah, so, all right, so with the daily routine, so in a nutshell, most of the monks are up at, say, 4:30, and then we meditate, we walk and sit during the morning, come up for the breakfast. And so breakfast is at 6:30, 7:15. We have 4 mornings of work a week. So it's not really much at all. And sometimes, you know, we may work an extra day or two. And some of us have, we may do groups, say like in the early evening, local groups. Or it could be like house invitations, wedding, it could be wedding invitations, could be funerals, hospital visits, they can come up during the late afternoon or the evening. But luckily for me, I really don't, I'm at the top of the line at the moment, but definitely some stuff just came up in the last couple of days, but I don't feel really stretched. You know, when I reach the point when I start getting stressed or I can't practice, then I would consider that to be a problem. You know, when I can't meditate properly, then I definitely start to question where I'm at that particular time. But we're very, very lucky. I mean, you know, Achan Brom and Achan Bromali, even though they're both out of the monastery at this moment, I've still got plenty of time to practice. what happened with the mind when we sleep at night, why things that we restrain during the day come up in night dreams. So when you sleep, your defilements get up on the stage and do a, what would you call it, live out their performances. People who have mastery of jhanas, and especially and unequivocally people who are fully enlightened, don't dream. They don't dream at all, and I've heard that from a number of senior teachers, because there's no underlying mental activity. There's no underlying greed, hate, delusion, which is the causal factor for this stuff that will basically get up on the stage and start performing. Even for example, in your dreams, your defilements get up on the stage and they start to perform, and they start to they create movies, and they create dramas, and they create fantasies, and you may feel some of the stuff is quite bizarre and weird and strange, but some of it can come up from distorted delusion. Defilement is based in delusion, lack of clarity, clear seeing. We can't really see exactly what's going on from this, like a very, very pure mind, undefiled mind. So essentially, for the average person, average monk and nun, the defilements are basically running the show. So what you're dreaming about comes from these things, these impurities in the mind that we actually have to work with and that we have to overcome in order to access deep meditation and for the realization of the path. So if you're restraining things during the day and they come up in sleep, you can have a situation where if you repress stuff, I've seen this previously, in monasteries where the teacher is really, really tight, the Thai monks can deal with this. They tend to deal with this much more skillfully. I've been in monasteries where the standard was very tight, but the monks were still fairly happy and relaxed. They were fast, and they were very clean, tidy, this and that, but they weren't like stressed. But it comes from like an Asian mentality, kind of attitude. But in the West, I've seen a strict monastery where the young monks, they were basically in a state of both emotional tension all the time. It affects people's moods and the way they relate with each other. If you're more restrained on this, with the retreat mode, you may be more restrained if you go into a Christian church, or if you're in the monastery, you're going to be naturally more restrained, because you're looking at appropriate behavior in time and place in these settings. But I tend to encourage people to, if you're going to be restrained in certain environments, try to do it in a natural way. Don't get too stiff and don't get too uptight, because it'll start affecting you. Because even with the monks and nuns, usually find, our monastery is quite relaxed. Our standard is definitely quite, it's pretty good overall. It's not at the same level as the tightest monasteries you get in Thailand, which is on a different ball game. But people, they can work together, they can practice together. We don't have major conflicts between people. and you know, things get done. You know, sometimes you know you're getting issues coming up, but it's like, you know, like storms in a teacup kind of thing. But if you repress, you know, if you start to get really tight and repressive, then those underlying energies, you know, if they can't come out in your waking state, they potentially can come out in your dreams, because you know you get things like unfulfilled wishes and desires. And so, for example, you're a person who's like, let me think now. Somebody like, as an example, somebody like, say, like Fred Nile, or these very, very strict, conservative, evangelical, say, church leaders. Maybe these males that you see in the U.S. or even in the Australian fraternity, who are very, very moral, and they have this very, very strong standpoint, and they've got all sorts of very firm views and opinions on almost anything. And then later, you know, they catch these guys out for, I don't know, could be anything, could be molesting their female disciples, touching children inappropriately, downloading pornography on the internet, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, even with the Christian people, it's my mentality is to if you need to be restrained, I mean, monks and nuns need to be restrained, but just keep yourself in a comfortable range, you know, so you can sort of, you know, you can basically behave and sort of interact like reasonably normally. Because, you know, I've seen this kind of thing before, it doesn't have, you know, even the general society, sometimes, you know, you get sort of, you know, unusual effects, you know, coming up. Can you please repeat the method you explained when your mind is so busy that it stops you from quietening your mind? Thank you. So what I would do, that watching the darkness in the mind, I you know, because I know different meditation techniques. I don't do this very often, but I found that quite good, actually. So, you know, if you sit in a dark room or, you know, semi-dark room, and just watch that darkness, that dark space in the mind. The Christians might call it they might call that sort of quiet pace the devil's playground. Some Christian people, they say that, you know, if you make the mind too quiet, you know, just make space for the devil to come in. But you might find that quite easy to start with. You could use that as a beginning point, focusing on that dark space in the mind. And once you're able to establish and hold attention, then you can possibly maybe bridge to even, say, feeling in the body or the breathing meditation. So you just work it out, see what works for you. And say, for example, you know, you're trying to meditate and your mind is just completely crazy. So no matter what you do, you just can't get any peace at all. You know, all the techniques that you know just basically don't work, and the mind is just spinning endlessly. What I would do is just watch the thinking process, just very relaxed. Just watch it scream away. The mind can think as much as it like. It can scream on and on and on. And then experiment with it. Just watch it, say, for 5 minutes. And don't judge it. Don't push it away. Don't grab hold. Just watch it like you're watching a movie. Because you're still establishing mindfulness, you're still establishing a state of focused attention, relaxed focused attention. And then if you want to try something different, start to label the thought processes, and then that starts to become like an insight practice. Because you're labeling the thought processes. And you know, thinking of different people, locations, events, views, opinions, and you label these things in a very relaxed way. Maybe every couple of seconds, every 5 seconds, so you can do it for, you know, whatever minimum. So it could be at least 20-30 minutes, And then you start to see connections between different thoughts and feelings, times and locations. And so, you know, you start to see how your mind works and what triggers certain events and thought processes and attitudes. And so when you do that over time, you start to see the mind, it'll start to slow down. When you watch the mind and you watch all the tricks and you watch all the different energies and the behaviors and the things that the mind does under the force of the defilements, then you get an insight. You're labeling, and you start to see connections. You start to see the way the mind works, and then it could take a full 30 minutes. It could take an hour. But it'll start to slow down because you're gaining some insight into that activity. And when you reach a point, you may reach a point where the mind starts to settle down enough, then maybe you could bridge to that dark space in the mind, or maybe you could bridge to the breathing meditation, or maybe you may feel that you have to experiment to sort of go back and forth between that, just that neutral, say, watching, you know, observing, that neutral observing, and then this kind of labeling to gain insight. But the bottom line is, whatever induces a sense of peacefulness and a sense of insight in one's awareness, that is the way you should go. Dear Achanapi, could you please give some example of mantra for the body parts meditation? Thank you. So as I mentioned, all right, so the easy one, all right, say for example, all right, so the ones which are easy to work with are the external parts of the body, so head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin. These are the parts that you can see. You can see in oneself, see in other people. And then you can start with just that very, very simple, just one single mantra. Either head hair is changeable, body hair is changeable, nails, teeth, skin. Just one mantra is changeable or changeable in nature. Big spaces between the words. And if you want to put it to the test, do it for minimum, say 5-10 minutes. Watch the level of activity in the mind. And then once you get the mantra rolling, do it very relaxed, very spacious. And then watch the level of thinking activity. And easily after 5 minutes, you should see it start to drop. You know, you should see that the mind start to quieten at least to a small degree. And if it's not, say for example, you're a person whose mind is incredibly busy. You do the body contemplation mantra, one mantra in the beginning, and then after 5 minutes, look at the mental activity, look at the thoughts, the feelings, and if the mind is still overactive, is thinking about something in particular, and then stop right there and start to investigate, because you've got 5 minutes of samadhi under your belt. And then focus on investigation of whatever is happening right there. The thoughts, feelings, mind states, whatever it is. Could be anything. You could be thinking about the man and the moon. You know, just examine it, try to understand everything about it, because it's insight which will release these things, these attachments. And then after you finish with that, go back to the body contemplation mantra, maybe another 5 minutes, and then keep moving back and forth between body contemplation mantra and this wisdom-based insight investigation of states, mind states. And you should see, if you do that for 30 minutes, you might be pleasantly surprised how the quality of the meditation you can get. But, you know, if you really want to see very, very quick results, then go like inside the body. You know, I mean, skeleton is really, really good. might sound a bit weird, but if you really want to see some action and see one's meditation really start to roll, get your anatomy book, get on the internet, get a very, very clear visual perspective of the skeleton top to bottom. You can see all the bones absolutely crystal clear, size, shape, location, and look at that skeleton for several minutes or even 5 minutes. And as soon as you start to roll that mantra, skeleton is changeable or skeleton is changeable in nature, easily, within 5 minutes, that skeleton will be there. And it will be there, if you don't stop, it will be there for 3, 4, 5 hours. And you can do it effortlessly. I've done it for 5 hours. And, you know, and I don't consider myself to have incredible sati. It's very, very easy. But you'll find, because it's internal. I mean, skeleton can be quite... most people should be able to handle a skeleton. Some people get a bit squeamish. But, you know, if you want to really see... results. You can do. There's a number of ways you can do. So, for example, the skeleton's too heavy. Internal component parts of the body is just really heavy. It's a bit gross. Go externally and do the five external parts of the body: head, hair, body, hair, nails, teeth, skin. Five mantras, one after another. You know, back and forth, back and forth. Same thing. Very relaxed and watch the mind very carefully. Do one. Experiment with it. Do one mantra for 5 minutes. Do five mantras for 5 minutes and watch the way the mind responds. If you feel that the mind is still not getting peaceful enough, you can go through the 32 component parts of the body. You don't necessarily, if you're squeamish, you don't have to visualize them, because without being too gross, once you get the visual image of the body parts, as soon as you run right through brain, heart, liver, kidneys, pancreas, intestine, bladder, you know, could be anything, right through, all those component parts will appear to you as you move through the list. They'll just be flashing at you as you go through. But you need to be a little bit careful with that practice, and you can experiment with it if you really want to see where it can take you. I went over the top with this, and I had nightmares for like several days, and I thought, oh God, I better lighten up on this. But it's just the amount of pressure you're putting on with the thinking process, the underlying thoughts and feelings. You're really putting maximum pressure, and sometimes you can get bad reactions. So if the defilements, they can't get you when you're fully conscious, when you're walking and talking with your eyes open, they'll get you when you're dreaming, and they can come up with really, really frightening stuff. And I've been almost shaking, you know, on my bunk, in the forest, or you know, I just peed myself completely. I had this monster broke into the kuti. I was on the bunk, you know, I was asleep, I was on my back. This hairy monster about six and a half feet tall, with big hairy mitts and claws, like a grizzly bear. Just imagine a standing grizzly bear. That gives you an idea. Like, was bashing on the door, couldn't get in, and he just smashed the door down. He just dived on me, had me round the throat, and he was throttling the hell out of me. And I was so petrified, I just completely peed myself. And I was absolutely paralyzed. I couldn't move for about 60 seconds while this thing was strangling me. And then I just woke up in my eyes, like, wide with terror. And then I realized it was a nightmare. And then it took me another 30 seconds another 30 seconds before I had sort of conscious control of my body. I was even able to move my fingers and toes, and I was able to relax, and then I drifted off into a very, very deep state of sleep. And I woke up in the morning, I was very, very refreshed. But that, you know, that's like an extreme. You know, this is just information, but I'm just letting you know that's a kind of extreme state which can come up if you overdo this kind of thing. Right. Okay. You didn't get a chance to finish your story of the Buddha as an ascetic when, said the 29-35 year his birth duration under the two wise teachers who were between levels 7 and 8. Thank you for your diversity of stories, examples, monastic and personal experience, as well as ancient teachings. All of you people will be able to find the, I think you, it should be there. If you haven't got the suttas in digital, you may find it in Achantanisro's Access to Insight, that specific sutta on the Buddha's experience with those two senior samadhi teachers. So, you know, I mean, that level of samadhi, you don't meet many people, even in the current age, who have that level of samadhi. I mean, it's really quite special. And, you know, any of the enlightened, both the Buddha and any of the enlightened teachers in Thailand will tell you, you don't need to go past the fourth jhana for maximum power in insight practice. To give you an idea what the capability is, that any person, regardless of circumstances, to a full extent, has mastery of the first jhana, can go right through to the arahata level, can finish their spiritual work completely, just with the basis of the first jhana. But if you have upachara samadhi, the limit potential is the sotapanna experience. You can attain sotapanna with upachara samadhi, but you can't attain the higher stages with upachara. There's not enough stillness, purity, enough mind power. You're looking at depth. Like when you're looking at deep, the deeper the samadhi, the more depth you've got with insight practice, because the mind's incredibly still, and when it goes into something, it just goes, it penetrates and goes right into the fabric of whatever you're trying to analyze or comprehend. Nothing obstructs you. You go right as deep as you possibly can go into an experience, and you understand absolutely everything about that particular mind state, feeling. It could be anything. It could be a physiological process, or it could be a deva experience, or you know, all sorts of things. But those guys, if you die with that level of meditation, you are reborn in those jhana worlds. So the world of Mahabrahma, who is the creative god for the Muslims, Christians, Hindus, and the Jewish fraternity, he is at the mastery level of the first jhana. That is his world, that Brahmaloka level. And you have three of those worlds for the first jhana: second, third, and fourth. You have 16 in total. And what am I saying? Four, three. No, what am I saying? Three. You have the four jhanas. You have three levels. You have minor mastery, middle mastery, and full mastery of the jhana states. And so for the first, second, third, fourth jhana, you are reborn in those jhana worlds according to your level of mastery. So the Christian god is at the level of the first jhana mastery. So you can go much, much, much higher than that. And above that, you've got the worlds which correspond with the immaterial jhana. So infinite. These are pure states of perception. So I'm just using words to describe the experience, but incredibly, incredibly profound states of pure perception, infinite space, infinite consciousness, state of nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception, but So, you know, you just imagine the first jhana, if any, you know, just the way the forest masters explain, if any of you had the first jhana experience, it would completely blow you away, absolutely, and you would never forget that for the rest of your life. So if you go beyond that point, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, then it gives you some kind of perspective on how far you can go in this practice. And then you have the what they loosely call the ninth jhana, which is Nirodha Samapatti, the cessation of thinking and feeling, of both any kind of mental activity and any kind of super sensual experience in deep meditative absorption. So all that is completely suspended, and then you have the deepest, most profound level of realization that a human being can access, you know, like while they're, you know, while they're conscious and so, you know, conscious and alive, so to speak. But then again, but you know, but that seven and eighth jhana, you know, you can do that for several lifetimes. You could do that for three, four lifetimes, but if you don't investigate and contemplate, you will not break through, even to the Sotapanna level. And they've had teachers in Thailand who had incredible samadhi, and because of the suppression effect, and because of that pure mind, that pure radiant mind, where I mean, essentially like insight flows effortlessly from that mind, but the on a very, very deep level, the defilements are still there, they're still active, but you can't see them. It's like a big heavy stone covering a patch of grass. The person can't, you know, they've got this incredible mind that they're experiencing, and that you can get psychic phenomena, you can get all sorts of different things, which can arise from those that very, very deep states of samadhi. But the defilements are basically at the surface to the intermediate level. The defilements are basically inactive. You can't see them. So, for example, if somebody got into, I actually heard this from a senior teacher, if they got into a second jhana, like for several hours, for like minimum 2 to 3 hours, you can't see the defilements at all for 48 hours. Your mind is so pure. There's no greed, hate, lust, or delusion. Mind's incredibly bright, clear, and it understands, really, like it really understands things to a very, very deep level. But once you stop meditating, those defilements, they rise up, and then they become active again. Why does one feel lost when trying to meditate? Feel lost, feel lost in the sense of, there could be a couple of things there, like sometimes everyone experiences this. Say, for example, you're meditating, usually you need to sit and walk for about at least usually 1 or 2 hours, and then if somebody like puts you in, maybe in charge of a project, or if they had you maybe walk into a bank or maybe drive through the city, you may feel that your sensory awareness is impaired, your memory, your thinking, and your sensory awareness is impaired. To give you an idea, it just came up in my mind. Achyam Brahm had a disciple who was a senior business manager, so a very, very smart guy. But he loved to meditate. He was under stress, under pressure. There was some kind of takeover with the company. He had some guy who was basically almost trying to assassinate him to get his management position. You know how ruthless some people can be. And what happened was, this guy was quite a decent person. He'd been meditating for at least 12 months at that time. So, you know, definitely not a ruthless, vindictive, revengeful individual at all. And the guy who basically pushed him out of the company and got his high class managerial position. He even took that guy to breakfast, and paid for the breakfast and said, look Tom, he said, I understand that he was talking about the company dynamics. You know, these guys know exactly, why these things happen and the underlying principles and whatnot. He said, I've got nothing against you, and I wish you the best. And he shook the guy's hand, and he never saw him again. And he said that guy was absolutely blown away. No one had ever, behaved that way towards him in his life, because this guy's a real, how can I explain it? A real ruthless person. And he'd stolen this guy's job, and then this guy, this former manager, took him to breakfast and said, hard feelings and good luck. And the guy was speechless. He mumbled a few things in reply, but he told Achyam Brahm, he was so emotionally over, how can I explain it? He was so emotionally affected, he didn't even know what to say to this guy. No one had ever treated him like that through the course of his professional life. Without sidetracking, this particular gentleman was driving myself and Achyam Brahm into the city, and very, very smart guy, but he actually got lost. We were going to a particular restaurant for one of his Thai lady friend, close friend, and he got lost. He took a couple of turns, and his peripheral awareness was affected. Everyone knows that when they meditate, they've got to be a bit more careful. You know, when you're doing your banking, when you're driving the kids to school, because it affects you. It increases the space in one's mind, but you can get this kind of experience where you really don't know where you are and what you're doing. So you've got to be quite careful. So, for example, with professional people and doctors, like I always tell them, don't meditate before you go into the hospital or clinic, just in case you make a mistake. You've got to be sharp on the ball, with medical practitioners and specialists. They just can't afford to make mistakes whatsoever. They've got people's lives in their hands. But this specialist I knew, he did this 1 minute mantra, and without difficulty, he was doing it like 16 hours a day for weeks on end, but got a bit sensitive with that practice, but it didn't affect his judgment at all. He was still very, very sharp, and he was very on the ball, because he had, for example, when he was looking after his ladies with their babies who were due, he was fairly high ranking. I think it was going to take him 15 years to reach his top position, but he had junior doctors under his wing that he was advising with deliveries and procedures and this and that. And even then, I asked him, were your faculties clear? Were you sharp? Was your decision making accurate? Could you think and remember full speed? And he said, no problem whatsoever. And it actually made him sharper. It increased his peripheral awareness, made him intellectually sharper. So what I would tend to do, so for example, if your peripheral awareness, if I understand where you're coming from, you can always catch up with me later if necessary. If you really can't sense where you are, ground yourself in the body. Either do walking meditation, focus on the feelings in the hand, maybe the touch of the feet on one's floor, and ground yourself. Even if you do Anapanasati or whatnot, maybe you could finish off with some kind of body practice on sensation to pull you back to your bodily awareness, because you don't want to get lost in your mind too much. In maybe if you start to get a bit spacious, you don't want to get lost inside one's mind, and sort of pull yourself back into the physical body. Or even things like I can't say how workable this is, but even thinking, If you start to get overly peaceful, overly detached, just sit down and watch the thinking process deliberately stimulate thoughts, thinking, and memory, and get the mind spinning again. You know, but experiment with it and see what works for you. Who do you think you were in your past life, and why? When I was 15, I was already thinking about. I was already interested in Buddhism, meditation, the Zen masters and their sayings, their parables, and their discourses and this kind of thing. And I was meditating. I was doing a little bit of meditation, late teens, and I was reading books from 15 right through till 20, and then. My brother and I, we met quite a good teacher. He was originally, a kung fu teacher, but he was very well-rounded. He was into philosophy, he was into Tai Chi, Feng Shui, soft martial arts. So had a very, very good balance. And he had a meditation class, and we were meditating with him. And then we had the Thai monastery was only about an hour and a quarter away, so we went up and we stayed at the Thai monastery for maybe for at least 1 or 2 weeks at a time between, engineering contracts. And I get the impression, it's not something I can prove whatsoever, but I get the impression that I had a monastic connection in my last life. But, you know, it's anyone's guess where I was or who I was for how long. You've got to have very, very... solid psychic ability for this kind of thing. I mean, you can do it with Upachara Samadhi. I've had teachers tell me that you can recollect past lives with Upachara Samadhi, which gives some people some hope that they could still crack it. And my disposition, I definitely had maybe a slightly monastic kind of persona. I was interested in forests and interested in meditation and interested in living alone. I'd pack my my saddlebags with my, I had like big trail bikes and fairly large bikes, and I would just go away for days at a time, especially with the trail bikes. I could just go right out into national park areas and state forests, and I could just be out there for like 3, 4, 5 days by myself, and I would practice meditation and I would just cook my food and I had my books I'd just be sort of like sitting under the pine trees or on a grassy spot, for a layperson's experience, I just thought it was fantastic. So I thought I would just maybe up the ante and just get into this business full time. So I just had to reach a point where I had to make the decision to stop work, and by age 30 I was in the monastery and I've just stayed on to this this point. But it really suits my character, my personality, but with the as a monastic, you have to practice in a certain manner. There's certain practice that you have to do to keep your mind, your energies in balance in the long term when you're looking at 20, 30, 40 years. So what do you hope to be next? So the kind of mentality I have is to, just try to get as much practice as possible under my belt, and then when it comes time to die, to have that intention, to have that resolve that you regard, no matter where you are reborn, because you can get enlightened from the Devaloka realms, but you've really got to establish your mind quite firmly. And for example, any human being who does a lot of meditation, keeps their precepts, they study, they know the foundation principles of Buddhism, the vast majority of those people will be reborn in those Devaloka realms. And so you make your intention very, very firm. You can tell yourself every single day, every couple of days, if I should die tonight, because no one really knows what's in store for them. If I should die tonight, I want to keep practicing the Dharma and I want to attain Nibbana. You know, I want to break through to the enlightenment stages, because if you keep the lifetimes, you practice for whatever it is, it could be 5, 10, 20 years plus, and you should happen to die, you keep the practice rolling, you go into the second life, you keep practicing. The fastest way to get enlightened is to have several lifetimes in succession. Most people, you need at least two. This is the life histories of people. Say 2 to 3, and for the first stage, once you break through to the first stage, the time scale is incredibly short. As they move very, very fast from that point. They know exactly what they need to do. It's not necessarily a breeze, because the underlying defilements in the mind can still be quite tricky to work with, but comparatively, how long it's taken you to get to the first level and what it takes you to get from the Sotapanna to the Arahata stage, it's just like nothing by comparison. And I've heard senior teachers in Thailand say, if you put forth 100% effort, everything you've got, and you're under a good teacher, you know exactly what you're doing, people, they completely finish their spiritual work in 5 to 10 years, and 5 to 10 years is absolutely nothing by comparison. Venerable, what do you mean by the changeability factor? So many of you know that the Buddha said repeatedly the contemplation of anicca, dukkha, anatta, because you need to do that in order to get a sense of letting go, release, dispassion, maybe to a small degree. Changeability is very smooth and safe, and so is emptiness. But you've got to be careful; you don't get too too spacious, too detached. You know, otherwise you can just be floating around. You get like disconnected, and you've got to be careful with this kind of thing, especially when you're driving a vehicle or you're in a position of responsibility. You want to make sure you know what you're doing and you're grounded and you've got awareness. I was into the emptiness principle for some time, but after a couple of weeks, I had to basically shut it down, because I was at the top of the line, and I had it like a room full of people in front of me, and even on weekends, and I felt really quite disconnected, and I didn't really feel the need to even sort of speak to these people at all. Like I didn't have anything against them in any way, but I had no compulsion to talk to them hardly at all. And I thought this is not going to, this is not suitable. But as soon as I went to the anicca principle, the balance was just right. It was as good as it gets. And so I just experimented with that over the last couple of years, in different subjects, different practices, and for myself, it just worked very, very well. But it's exactly the way that the Buddha recommended that you go, because with insight, with letting go, with detachment and relinquishing, you've got to get into these practices. You can do your standard insight practice where you understand things on a worldly level, but you've got to use that either say the anicca principle, or say for example, somebody in say boyfriend, girlfriend connection, and then those guys have a really, really horrendous separation. The suffering will be right there in your face, and it's very tangible, you can even use like the suffering principle. One of the senior monks I knew in England, he would focus on that. He would focus on the disadvantages of relationships. So for guys, for the male monastics, disadvantages of intimate relationships with females, and for the nuns, the disadvantages of relationships with guys, because you basically, if you're a celibate monastic, you don't want those energies, I mean, at all, because it's quite disturbing. It obstructs your practice, and it can make life quite difficult. So, you know, you really want to get that kind of thing like under wraps, sort of fairly, you know, in a fairly short space of time. So he focused on the disadvantages, he didn't focus on dislike of female people or even male people if you happen to be gay, but that, you know, you just want to get a cooling effect, a balancing effect. So it's just one way of looking, at one's experience. And so, you know, there's quite a number of things you can do as far as vipassana. What is the discipline to forgiveness? Okay, so maybe say the method or the way to forgiveness. How do we forgive? How do we forgive other people? You know, so for example, somebody ripped me off in a major way. I mean, the first thing I'd do, I definitely wouldn't organise a hitman, that's for sure. But what I would do, the first thing I would do, is I would reflect on karma. That would be automatically the first thing that would come to mind. So if somebody cheats me, rips me off, sort of treats me really, really poorly, well, which I'm blessed, absolutely blessed. It doesn't happen too often, but it's nice that it does happen, because because we're mixing with very, very nice, good quality people. The monks and nuns don't get abused or assaulted very often, but I don't mind when it does happen, because you know it's nice to get a very, very clear a clear perspective. But so even, for example, with people in the world, you know, you're always going to find someone who's going to dish you, going to rag on you, this kind of thing. You probably see it almost every single day. So you reflect on karma. So whatever this person does, they're going to cop it, and they could cop it 10 times over. So whatever they do to you, because karma has a multiple factor format. And depending on what you do to who and where and how, will determine the strength and the forcefulness and the number of occasions it's going to come back and whack that person. So, you know, if somebody thinks they're a bit of a smart aleck, and they think I can run rings around other people and I can like rip off old grannies, you know, of their pension accounts or their retirement fund and all this kind of stuff. Nobody gets away with anything. So if you get these smart alecks, these really, really, you know, sharp, you know, cunning, deceitful kind of people, no matter how smart or how sneaky they are, you know, no one gets away with anything. You watch these guys very, very carefully, whether it's male or female. To give you an idea, one of our young monks many, many years ago had a friend. He was a novice, and he was an older novice, had a female friend, and her husband was one of these guys who was like a wheeler dealer, and he would always try and get the upper hand. He'd always try to rip people off at least a little bit, you know. Maybe, you know, who knows, maybe he felt that he was so fantastic he could rip almost anybody off. But over time, and he watched this guy very, very carefully, and this guy slowly started to develop this intestinal, intestinal yeast infection, which went right through him. Maybe something similar to like a candida kind of format. Like, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know specifically. But it not only affected his internal organs, his whole digestive tract, but it went through and it affected his skin, and he ended up with these very, very unpleasant, what would you call it, like lesions on the external body. It took a couple of years to kick in, so it just came up like internally, and then it just sort of went right through him. But that's after, I mean, you know, he'd probably been ripping people off, oh God, maybe probably well over 10 years. And then, and he ripped off, and he might be a bit strong in the language, but when he basically, he basically cheated a couple, like an older couple connected with the monastery, who were very, very nice people, you know, absolutely harmless and very, very kind and supportive. And then, you know, that novice monk of ours told that guy's wife, and just, I mean, tore that guy to his face, and really did not really cut loose and let him know. And he said, you may think that you're a bit of a smart aleck, and you know, you've got the upper hand, and you're a bit of a wheeler dealer, but, you know, just, you know, mark my words, my friend, you're going to cop it. And within 12 months, the symptoms started to appear, and then within 2 years or so, he had this major medical problem, which took like something like several years to basically fix. And that was, you know, that was with really, you know, people who specialized in this type of infectious processes, and it took a while to sort of shake it off. So that it was, you know, it was unsightly, it was itchy, he couldn't sleep properly, you know, he started getting stressed. So he really had a hard time with it. Bhante, peace, no peace, no stillness, hindrances. Yes, all five. Why am I here? Sadhu, times three. All right, so for example, if I put myself in your shoes and I had absolutely no peace of mind at all, the kind of practices I would use right from the start is I would experiment with these practices and put them to the test. The first thing I would do, just as an example, as a progression, I would focus on the darkness in the mind, and then do that for at least 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and see if it's effective at all. If you feel that it's effective, I would keep it going. The next step is, if the mind is absolutely crazy, then just watch the thinking process. That's all you do. Just watch it, like you're like a cat watching a mouse, and don't judge it, don't push it away, don't grab hold of it. Just watch it, like in a detached manner, and because you're developing mindfulness, you're developing sharpness, awareness, and you're actually seeing what's going on in one's mind. And then do that for 5-10 minutes and watch the effect. Watch how it affects you. And then the third step is start to label the thought processes. You know, label the people, label the circumstances, the events, the feelings, the attitudes, the views, the perceptions. You know, label them, so you know what they are and where they come from. And just do it in a very relaxed way, very, very spacious. Don't put yourself under any pressure. You're just trying to learn from this experience. And then put these three methods, put them to the test. And also, you can also focus on feeling in the body. So draw your attention away from thinking. Focus on tangible feeling in the body. So if I'm really cerebral and my mind's absolutely crazy, put your attention down low on your hands, put it on the soles of your feet, and watch how the mind responds, you know, with these practices. Some will work better than others. And if you're not sure, just go right through them. You know, if you meditate every day, maybe do one practice for a couple of days running, and see, you know, what actually happens. And then, you know, next couple of days, try that a second practice, a third, a fourth, and eventually you'll find one where you start to see the dynamics, and it's working for you. It's effective. You actually start to see some progress, maybe some stillness of mind, some stability of mind. And then whatever of those tools, those beginning tools, are effective, then go that way. You may have to experiment, you may have to swap and change, but as soon as you, with these kind of bridging meditations, as soon as you get some at least a little bit of peace of mind. Possibly you might be able to go to the breathing meditation or the walking meditation. So it's that same thing again. Put these particular practices to the test and see what works for you, and experiment. You know, always be reflective and look at the results of the direction that you're moving in. So, I'm amazed I can still talk. When I talk, it's only a little thing, but if you do public speaking or this or that, drop your attention right down deep into your belly, and then you'll find that you can keep pushing the energy out for hours and hours on end. Like, I'm reasonably quiet, but I can actually talk for several hours without great difficulties. As soon as people start talking from the voice box, they get exhausted quite quickly. But when you drop your attention down low into the abdomen and right where the tantian is, you find that you can keep pushing the energy outwards. Was there any nothing else anyone needed to say? We're all doing okay.